Welcome to Aggressive Life. Before we start our discussion today, I want to tell you something I'm really fired up about. It's not Athletic Greens. That's coming later on. What I'm really fired up about is couples camp. I don't know anything that's more important to a person's life than having a strong marriage, if you're married. And I know that I'm kind of typecast as the man guy. Part of that's because I am a man. Part of that's because I have a calling to blow out man camp. I love man camp. There's nothing like it. It's got crazy, stupid traction. Don't tell anybody this, but here's the deal. I actually like couples camp more than I like man camp. Yes, we have a experience just for couples. What can you do if you're married to take your marriage to the next level? Where do you go? You maybe go to a marriage counselor, which is great. You're going to pay less than a marriage counselor for an entire weekend, and I promise you, you're going to get more out of a weekend at couples camp than you will with one session with a marriage counselor. You're going to interact with other people who are pro-marriage, interact with other people who have some of the same struggles you have, interact with other people who have gotten beyond your struggles, having uplifting worship, some really good teaching. It's just great to laugh with couples and have fun. Please get there. We're doing all we can to make it easy. It happens in April, right around the corner. You can go to crossroads.net/couplescamp, get 10% off, and I'm making it even easier for you. I've thrown my weight around, and even though some people didn't like the idea, I liked it, so I made it happen. We're doing car camping if you want to this year, couples camp. That means you don't have to walk in with all your gear. You can drive in. You can maybe sleep in your minivan. You can maybe sleep on top of your rooftop tent if you have one. You can maybe bring in 500 pounds of blankets and gears and whatever you want and only have a short walk back to your car to resupply. I'm trying to make it as simple and easy as possible because I want you to have a great marriage. The most defining thing for your future, if you're married, is your marriage. Make it a priority. What have you done for it recently? What have you done for it ever since you said I do? Most people, nothing. Hey, how about doing something different? Try Couples Camp. Push yourself. You'll be glad you did. Crossroads.net/couplescamp. Welcome to The Aggressive Life. We've hosted some really great people on the podcast. Dirt, you may not make a great team because you get some real finds here.
Thanks, man. Thank you.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, seriously. You do love it and it shows. Today, this one might take the cake. We're talking with Daryl Davis. He's an accomplished blues pianist, played with legendary artists like Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, B.B. King. And one night after he was playing a gig, he struck up a conversation with a patron who approached him to say that, quote, he'd never heard a black man play as well as Jerry Lee Lewis. Over drinks, the man confessed to being a member of the KKK. And since that initial encounter, Daryl has purposefully struck up relationships with a number of members of the Klan. And since this is a podcast, let me tell you before we go any further, Daryl Davis is an African American. That would make it very odd that you would actually seek out people who aren't just white, but who are in white robes with a history of killing people who look like you. What would compel him to engage with people who hate him? What would make him make such an aggressive move as that? Well, I'm hoping to find that out today. Please welcome to The Aggressive Life, Daryl Davis!
Thank you, Brian. My pleasure to be here. Really appreciate it.
Well, it's good to have you here. I kind of want to hear you sing. I know you played an instrument, but that deep voice of yours, you should be singing for us.
Next time, I'll do that.
Next time? You can't do anything a cappella right now?
I just did a big show last night.
Oh.
Honest to goodness, yeah.
All right, all good, all good. So tell me this. Were you, as most people of your skin tone, fearful of people who were in the Klan? And what was going through your mind, your process, the first guy you interacted with?
No, actually, I was not fearful of them. Hmm. And I think that was probably due to my childhood upbringing. And let me explain that to you. I'll be 66 years old next month. And I grew up as a child of parents in the U.S. Foreign Service. So I grew up as an American embassy kid, traveling all over the world, starting at the age of three. So now today, as a professional musician, I've played around the world. Hmm. So when you take my childhood travels and my adulthood travels and combine them, I have played in all 50 states. I have been to 63 countries on six continents. So what does that mean other than I have a lot of frequent flyer miles and hotel points? What it means is I have been exposed to a multitude, a wide variety of cultures, you know, skin colors, ideologies, religions, belief systems, cultures, etc. And all of that has helped shape who I have become. And so I just view white supremacists, whether I'm dealing with the Klan or neo-Nazis, just, you know, the general run-of-the-mill racist next door or something, I just view that as another culture. No matter how far I go, no matter who I meet, who may look different than me, may not speak my language or worship as I do, I always conclude one thing, that everybody I have encountered is a human being. And as such, every human being wants these five core values in their lives. Everybody wants to be loved. They want to be respected. They want to be heard. They want to be treated fairly. And they want the same things for their family as you or I would want for ours. And if we can learn to treat people with those five core values, regardless of the hot topic, it doesn't always have to be about race. You mean, in fact, let's take race off the table for a second. It could be abortion, nuclear weapons, global warming, the upcoming presidential election, the past presidential election, the war between Ukraine and Russia, or Gaza and Israel. These are all hot topics. You're on one side, somebody else is on the other side. I guarantee you, if you treat your adversary with these five core values, not only will you have a civil conversation, you will be able to navigate in a more positive and more smooth direction. So that's what I seek.
So when you saw this first gentleman in the KKK, did they want to talk with you? Did they not want to talk to you? How did that even go?
Okay, so I sought out the leader. What I figured I would do is I would go around the country. There had never been a book written by a black author on the Klan from in-person interviews, obviously, right? I wanted to do that. So I figured I'd go around the country, up north, down south, Midwest, west, and interview different Klan leaders and members. I was going to start right here where I live currently in the state of Maryland. So I managed to get the phone number of the leader for the Maryland KKK.
Okay, stop leader. Right there. Okay, hold on. Stop right there. How do you find the phone number of the KKK leader for Maryland?
Well, that goes to another story. All right. So I was, I majored in music, you know, graduated college with my degree and started playing professionally. Well, there came a time when country music had made a resurgence. So a lot of bars and clubs changed their format from top 40 to country. So, you know, I'm a full-time musician. You know, if you want to make a living, you got to play what people want to hear. So I joined a country band. I like country music. Nothing wrong with that. And I was the only black guy in the band, right? So as you mentioned earlier, I was playing in a bar, and this guy approached me and said, you know, this was the first time he'd ever heard a black man play piano like Jerry Lee Lewis. And I explained to him where Jerry Lee Lewis and I got our influences, you know, from black blues and boogie-woogie piano players. Well, he didn't believe that at all because he'd never seen a black guy, I mean, play like that. You know, so I figured he never saw Little Richard or Fats Domino. It's the same boogie style, right? And I said, look, man, I know Jerry Lee Lewis. He's a good friend of mine. You know, he's told me himself where his influences were. The guy didn't believe that either, but he wanted to buy me a drink. So I went back to his table, let him buy me a cranberry juice. And he took his glass, right, and he clinks my glass and cheers me. And then he makes this big announcement. You know, this is the first time I ever sat down and had a drink with a black man. Now, I'm baffled. At that point in my life, I had sat down literally with thousands, tens of thousands of white people or anybody else and had a meal, a beverage, a conversation. How is it that this guy, who's at least a decade and a half older than me, had never sat down with a black guy? I said, why? And he didn't answer me, like stared down the tabletop, didn't say anything. I asked him again. His buddy elbowed him and said, tell him, tell him. And I said, tell me. He looked at me and he said, I'm a member of the Ku Klux Klan. I started laughing at him because now I didn't believe him, right? He went inside his wallet, flipped out through it, handed me his Klan membership card. I stopped laughing. I recognized the Klan emblem, which is a red circle with a white cross and a red blood drop in the center. This thing was real. But he was very friendly. He was as curious about me as I was about him, which proves, you know, when you don't know one another and you talk, you find things in common. And that's exactly what we did. So sometime later, not that night, but sometime, you know, he gave me his phone number because he wanted me to call him whenever I was to perform there again. Huh. He was going to bring his friends, meaning Klansmen and Klanswomen,
wow,
to see the black guy who plays like Jerry Lee. I'm not sure he called me a black guy to his friends, but, you know.
Right, right.
That's how he explained it to me.
He called you an African-American to his friends.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'd call him every 6 weeks and say, hey, man, you know, we're going to be down there. He'd come, he'd bring Klansmen and Klanswomen, and they'd watch me play. But, you know, it dawned on me a little while later that, Daryl, the answer, you know, I had a question from the age of 10 when somebody threw rocks and bottles at me when I was the only black Cub Scout marching in a parade, an otherwise all-white parade. And I didn't understand it. And I had formed a question in my mind, which was, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? And I'd been looking for the answer to that question. Hmm. So it dawned on me a few years later, Daryl, the answer fell right into your lap. Who better to ask that question of than someone who would go so far as to join an organization that has over 100-year history of practicing hating people who don't look like them and who don't believe as they believe. And so I said, you know what? I'm going to get in contact with that Klansman. I'm going to, you know, get him to hook me up with the Klan leader. And I'm going to start right here in Maryland, interview this guy, start a book, and travel around the country and ask all these Klan people that question. Hmm. So that's how that whole thing started.
So before you tell me about the guy in Maryland, the first Klansman you talked to, I'm curious, the guy who said you played like Jerry Lee Lewis, he obviously, I got to admit, I don't know that much about the Klan. I assume the Klan just hated all people who weren't white and wanted them all dead. But yet he's having you, buying you a drink. So is there some nuanced belief the Klan held or holds?
Well, Brian, you are a rational person. You're logical. And you are looking for rationale where there is none. Okay? So, you know, you're struggling because you think, you know, this is not rational. How can this man be in the Klan and invite this black guy to his table, want to buy him a drink and hang out and talk and whatever else? You're right. That is not rational behavior. But then again, to be a racist is irrational. To judge somebody on the color of their skin, solely on that, is irrational. So if you're already irrational, you're going to do other irrational things, like invite that guy to sit at your table. Mm. It makes perfect sense.
Oh, that's funny. Wow. Okay. So I got to think that you meet with the head of the Klan in Maryland, and he's not as nice as the Jerry Lee Lewis guy, or is he as nice? What's he like?
Well, yeah, he was. I had to convince this guy. And I persuaded him to give me the leader of Maryland. Now, a state leader is what's known, and let me give you the hierarchy.
Yeah.
Okay, a state leader, which you and I would call the governor, in Klan terminology, that individual is known as the Grand Dragon. Anybody on the grand level means that they're a state officer, Dragon being the top, all right? A Grand Clayliff would be like a lieutenant governor. So, you know, they oversee the state. Somebody who oversees all the states in which they have a chapter, we would call the president. They call that person the imperial wizard. Anybody on the imperial level is national, right? So an imperial clayliff would be like a vice president. So
these people got issues. First of all, I don't understand their costume with the sheets and the pointy hats. I mean, you could have something that looks a little more cool. Secondly, these are stupid monikers. Grand Dragon?
Well, what? Let me explain that to you.
What are you like?
Yeah.
What geek are you? Plays Dungeons and Dragons in their mom's basement. Oh, my. Hold on. There's real Klansmen who could kill me right now. I need to, like,
mellow
it down.
Yeah.
Just because I'm white doesn't mean I'm void of getting violence against me.
That is true.
So, all right. So,
and you know what?
Yes.
they would hate you more than they would hate me.
Oh, why is that?
Because you are betraying your race, and you are the same race as they are, so you are betraying them.
Because I'm talking with a black man, or because I'm poking fun at their stupid costumes?
Because you're poking fun at their costumes, okay? But now let me explain that to you. Right. So the original Klan, when it was first formed, was formed by six Confederate soldiers at the end of the Civil War. And these soldiers were of Irish and Scottish descent. And they had come from the Masons, you know, the Scottish Rite. So as you know, the Masons are kind of a secretive organization. And they have all these mystical names, you know, grand this, grand that, exalted so-and-so, et cetera, et cetera. So what they did was they borrowed that template and changed the words around a little bit, the titles around. So that's where it comes from. Now, let me be clear. Not all Masons are in the Klan or anything like that. It's two separate groups, and not all Masons are racist by any means.
Okay.
So they wanted to be a secretive organization, and thus they put on the bed sheets and pillowcases and cut eyes in the pillowcases to look through and see people. So it added some, you know, mystique to it, if you will. And of course, it would become violent, and it became kind of a para law enforcement group that would, you know, because now blacks were freed. But they better know their place, and we're here to keep them in their place. That was a big part of the Klan's formation.
Okay. So you go and meet the Grand Poobah, Grand Wizard of Maryland. How did he treat you?
Okay. So I was told by the guy that I met in the bar, the Jerry Lee Lewis fan, I had to persuade him to give me this guy's phone number and address. He didn't want to do it. He was fearful. For his safety and mine, he finally gave it to me on the condition that I not tell this gentleman where I got his personal information. I said, okay. So the gentleman's name, the Grand Poobah, was named Roger Kelly. And he said, Darryl, do not fool with Roger Kelly. He will kill you. So I had my secretary call him. My secretary is white. And I figured, you know, I could have called him. I'm the one who had the number.
Interesting.
But if I called, you know, he might detect in my voice that I'm black.
Right.
So I said, call this guy, tell him you're working for somebody who's writing a book on the Klan. Would he consent to sitting down with your boss and doing an interview? Do not tell him that I'm black. If he asks, don't lie to him, but don't allude to it. She said, okay. So she called. He didn't ask. He agreed to do the interview.
Wow.
So we set it up for a motel room. Mary and I got there several hours early, got the room. I gave her some money, sent her down the hall to get soda pop out of the machine. Put it in the ice bucket, get ice in there, get it cold. I had no idea what this man was going to do when he arrived. Would he come in my room in an interview, like he said, like he told Mary? Will you look at me and say, I'm not talking to you, and walk away? Or would he attack me? I have no idea. But I knew what I was going to do. I was going to be hospitable. Just like, you know, if I invite you to my room or my house or whatever, I'm going to offer you a cold beverage. So I'm all ready, right? Right on time. Knock, knock, knock on the door. Mary hops up, runs around the corner, opens the door. In comes what's known as the Grand Nighthawk. Grand meaning state level. Nighthawk. Nighthawk means bodyguard. Nighthawk means bodyguard.
Okay.
So I need a Grand Nighthawk.
Darryl, yeah, would you like to be my Grand probably, Nighthawk?
You'll probably need one after this show.
All right. Go ahead, keep
going. So this Grand Nighthawk walks in, and on his hip, he had a semi-automatic handgun and a holster. Well, he comes around the corner and sees me and just freezes. Now, Mr. Kelly, the Grand Dragon, is on the other side of the corner, and he doesn't realize that his Nighthawk has stopped short. So he comes around the corner and slams into the guy's back and knocks the guy forward. And now they both are stumbling around trying to regain their balance, and they're like looking all around the room. And I'm just sitting there, you know, at my table, you know, looking at them. And I could read their faces. They were thinking, did the desk clerk give us the wrong room number, or is this an ambush? So I saw the apprehension, and I stood up and I went like this. I displayed my palms. So you see, I had nothing in my hands. And I walked towards Mr. Kelly. I said, hi, Mr. Kelly, I'm Darryl Davis. I put my hand out, and he shook my hand.
Wow.
As did the Nighthawk.
Huh.
And so far, so good. I said, please, come on in. Have a seat. Mr. Kelly sat down. The Nighthawk stood at attention to his right. And before I could sit down just opposite them, Mr. Kelly says, Mr. Davis, do you have any form of identification? I said, sure. I went through my wallet. I handed him my driver's license. And he looked at it. He goes, oh, you live on such and such street in Silver Spring. Well, now that had me a little concerned. Why is this guy reading my street address, right? And so I said, yes, Mr. Kelly, that is my address. And you live at, and I named his house number and his street. That way he knew that I knew where he lived. So, you know, if you come visit me, I'm going to come visit you.
Yes.
You know, we're leveling the playing field. We're going to keep all this visiting to this motel room right here. So he smiled. He nodded his head. So anyway, we got on with this interview. And every time Mr. Kelly would make a point or quote the Bible or something, you know, if I challenged it, I'd reach down and pull out my Bible, hand it to him to show me where it says that. Or I got a fresh cassette to put in my recorder. Every time I reached down like this, the Nighthawk would reach up like this, you know? Hand on gun. He never pulled it, but, you know, he put his hand on the butt of the gun. And so he was doing his job, so I understood that. He doesn't know me. I'm the enemy. He doesn't know what's in my bag. His job is to protect his boss. So I completely understood that. Well, after about 45 minutes of this, I reached down. He reaches up. He finally relaxed. And he realized there's no threat in my bag. So I went in and out of the bag. Nighthawk didn't move. After about an hour or so into this interview, Mr. Kelly and I are just sitting there talking, just casually. And out of nowhere, Brian, there was a very short, very fast noise, like a ch-ch-ch, and we all jumped. I went into survival mode. I feared for my life. I was getting ready to dive across that table, grab the Nighthawk, grab Mr. Kelly, slam them down to the ground and take away the Nighthawk's gun to immobilize the situation, because it's my job to protect myself and my secretary. But when I hit the table, I'm just inches from this guy's face. And I'm looking right into his eyes. I didn't say one word to him. My eyes were doing all the talking. In fact, my eyes were shouting so loud you could hear my eyes. My eyes were saying to him, what did you just do? Well, his eyes were fixated on mine. He didn't say a word, but I could read his eyes. His eyes were saying to me, what did you just do? And the Nighthawk's back like this with his hand on his gun again, looking at both of us like, what did either one of y'all just do? Well, Mary was sitting on top of the dresser to my left because there were no more chairs in the room. She realized what had happened. The ice in the ice bucket sitting next to her had begun melting and the cans of soda were falling down the ice. That was it, making that same noise.
Yeah.
And we all began laughing at how ignorant we all had been. You know, it was a teaching moment. And the lesson taught is this. Ignorance breeds fear. We fear those things we don't understand, those things of which we are ignorant, like that noise. If you don't keep that fear in check, that fear in turn will escalate into hatred. Because we hate the things that frighten us. If you don't keep the hatred in check, that in turn will escalate into destruction. Because we destroy the things that we hate. Why? Because they frighten us. But guess what? They may have been harmless and we were simply ignorant. So we saw that whole chain unfold almost to completion.
Right.
Had the Nighthawk drawn his gun or had I pounced across the table. All right. So, you know, we laughed and we carried on and continued the conversation. And that was great. So I began traveling the country after I interviewed him, but I would always come back to him. I even invited him down to my house. He'd sit right here on my couch, you know, and he'd bring his Nighthawk. Nighthawk sit next to him. Sometimes Nighthawk pull up a gun and twirl it on his finger like this because he's bored, right? This went on for a couple years.
Also because he's a dumbass. That's why I call Nighthawk's bluff. Nobody knows how to handle a gun would ever twirl the gun like that because he's bored. He's bored. He's not bored. He just doesn't know how to handle a gun.
I hear you. In any event, this went on for a couple years. During those 2 years, Mr. Kelly never invited me to his house. He'd come down to my house, or if I was heading up to his county, I'd call him and say, hey, man, what are you doing? Come run this errand with me. He'd say, okay, I'll meet you wherever. He always wanted to meet me at some park and ride. He didn't want me to come to his house, right? So after the first year, though, he was coming to my house by himself. No Nighthawk. He trusted me that much. After the second year of not inviting me to his house, he got promoted from Grand Dragon, state leader, to Imperial Wizard, national leader. And at that point, he began inviting me to his house because he called the shots, right? And I'd go to his house. I'd see his clan den, take some pictures, take some notes from my book. And then he started inviting me to clan rallies. I'd go to these clan rallies.
No, hold on, hold on. Hold on. Let me stop you to mind. Before you take me to clan rallies, because I want to keep hearing there, like, is he ever saying something like, I like you, I just can't make it public because of my job? You're saying stuff like, I have respect for people who are black, I just think that we shouldn't be married. I mean, is he saying anything that's coherent in this whole process?
I would hear that from different people in different clan groups.
Okay.
But with him, you know, he trusted me because I was transparent. He knew I did not agree with his ideology, but I wanted to learn about it. And I was treating him very fairly. You know, I was letting him say his piece. You know, people want to be heard. I allowed him to be heard. So I said, look, man, you know, I need to see one of these rallies. So he's the Imperial Wizard. So he arranged it, right? So now, you know, some of his members did not like that too much.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they were a little upset. But when you join these things, it's like a Simon Says, you follow the leader. So even though they didn't like me, there was nothing they could do. All right, so I did a bunch of those things. And as a result, over time, and my applying those five core values I told you about, Mr. Kelly left the Klan based on our conversations.
Wow.
And he gave me his robe and hood. And since that time, you know, I've gotten tons of robes and hoods, swastika flags, all kinds of stuff from active members of neo-Nazi groups and KKK groups and other white supremacist type groups and just individual racists because of the conversations, not just the conversation, but how you hold the conversation. Listen, I'm a firm believer that a missed opportunity for dialogue is a missed opportunity for conflict resolution. You know, if you spend 5 minutes with your worst enemy, you're going to find something in common. And then that gap closes in a little bit.
Yeah, right.
You spend another 5 minutes, you're going to find more. It closes in more. When you get here, you are having a relationship with your enemy, whether you like it or not. You're in a relationship. It's cordial. You might not be going to his birthday party or something, but you're having a relationship, right? Keep on talking. You get a little closer. Now, you know, you're very friendly. And then, you know, you've found out and he's found out that you all have more in common than you do in contrast. And the trivial things that you have in contrast, such as skin color, or whether you go to a church, a synagogue, a mosque, or a temple, begin to matter less and less. And then they begin questioning their own ideology. Why do I hate that guy? He's no different than I am. And it causes a cognitive dissonance. And so they have to decide, you know, do I accept the truth and change my ideological path? Or do I deny the truth and continue living a lie?
Right. And when you went to that rally, was there anything there that surprised you?
It was surreal. I've been to a lot of them since. I've been doing this now for 42 years. But yeah, I see all these men and women in different color robes and pointed hoods and all that kind of stuff with these torches. And there's a big 20 to 30 foot cross. And they form a wide circle around the cross. The cross is wrapped in burlap. And the burlap has been soaked in what they call Klan cologne, or which is really diesel fuel or kerosene.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So they have these torches that are lit. And they parade around clockwise in this wide circle around this cross. And then one of the leaders, the Grand Dragon or Imperial Wizard, will shout, "Klansmen, halt." And they all stop. Klansmen face the cross, and they all turn inward. And then he'll say, "For my God," and they all bow down and repeat, "For my God, for my race, for my race, for my country, for my clan, white power, white power." And then he'll say, "Klansmen, approach the cross," and they all close in. They got their torches. "Klansmen, light the cross," and they drop the torches at the base of the cross, and whoosh, this thing just explodes into flames. And then they all back up and form that wide circle. And they all hold their arms straight out like they're a cross. That's kind of the salute, the cross.
Huh.
And then they give a bunch of racist speeches. And then the rally is over and they go to the sidelines where they have hot dogs and hamburgers and soda pop, you know, on these picnic tables off to the side. So, you know, standing there watching this was very surreal. Like, you know, these people are just as normal as you and I are by day in their jobs. And they have jobs. Police officers, school teachers, gas station attendants, work at the MVA, you know, work, you bag your groceries at the grocery store. Because, you know, being a Klansperson or Klan, you know, whether you're a Klanswoman or Klansman, does not pay your bills. You know, it's like Boy Scout leader. You have to have a regular job. And, you know, when you see them in their regular job, you know, you may never suspect unless they do something, weird to you or something like that. You might never suspect that at home they have this attire in their closet and they do these rituals at these rallies. So it was, you know, it was very surreal.
This is an odd question. I won't even caveat it. I'll just say it. Is there anything you saw that was redeemable or respectable about the Klan?
Yes. Everybody is redeemable. Now, does that mean everybody will be redeemed? No. Okay. That ideology is a learned behavior. What can be learned can be unlearned. It may take some time, but there will be people who have that belief. They've acquired it from wherever. And there are different reasons why people would join these kinds of things, which I'll go into in a second. But they acquire it from somewhere. And some of them will go to their grave being hateful, violent, and racist. Others, even, you know, some of the most vicious ones, who you think would never change, have come back to me and have changed and apologized, give me their robes and hoods and all that kind of stuff. So yes, they are redeemable. Now, in terms of respectable, there's nothing respectable about that ideology. But what you can respect in some cases is how some of them, you know, they have jobs, they support their family, they treat their kids very well. So, you know, there's some normalcy in that regard and which, you know, you respect. Now, they're not, you know, beating up their wife or whatever. Some do, but of course you would not respect that. Some, you know, influence their children to join, you know, this crazy, you know, belief system. You don't respect that. But other than that, yeah, they can be respectable just like anybody else.
I wonder how many people are in the Klan as a form of male bonding or having social ties and could take or leave the racist thoughts. I wonder how many this is just the thing I do. It's a way to hang out with my buddies. Do you have any opinion on that?
Well, yeah, sure. And there are those, you know, everybody's joined because they want to belong to something. They're not feeling secure in their own skin, if you will. Now, a lot of women, there are women, you know, Klanswomen as well.
Oh, there are. And, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're not on the same level as men because the Klan is also a very male chauvinist organization. So the females don't get the higher positions.
They could be a grand maiden or a grand wench or something like that.
They can be a grand clud, which is like a secretary or
grand clud.
A clagrath would be the secretary. Grand clud would be a chaplain. Yeah. Or chaplain, grand chaplain clud. So, and then some women, you know, really believe in it. You know, they're as racist and not more racist than some men. But oftentimes you will find a lot of women get into it because their husband is in it or their boyfriend is in it. And should she and the boyfriend break up, she can drop that whole ideology.
Yeah.
Unless she finds another boyfriend within the Klan, you know.
Right. Flying K Ranch. Today's episode is brought to you by them because I believe they're producing some of the most mouth-watering, healthy burgers, steaks, roasts I've ever had. They're in Findlay, Ohio. Flying K raises their beef with no hormones or antibiotics, so you know you're getting the most natural product. It's a family business, partnering with state and national certification boards to ensure both cattle and customers are happy. You can find out more, place your orders at Flying KRanchAngus.com. That's Flying KRanchAngus.com. I'm liking it a lot. Taking care of your health isn't always easy, but it should be at least simple. That's why for the last 2 years, I've been drinking AG1 every day, no exceptions, at home, on a hunting trip, camping off my motorcycle, no exceptions. It's just one scoop mixed in water once a day, every day, and it makes me feel ready to get moving. That's because each serving of AG1 delivers my daily dose of vitamins, minerals, pre and probiotics, and more. It's a powerful, healthy habit that's also powerfully simple. I like to have it in the morning. I have a 12 ounce of water, so right off the bat, I'm helping my hydration every single morning. This is the one product, if I had to recommend one, I'd recommend this one to elevate your health. It's AG1, and that's why I partnered with them for 2 years. So if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and five free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/aggressivelife. That's drinkag1.com/aggressivelife. Get yourself some. How are you feeling, Daryl, during a couple years ago when our racial issues in America, they were blown out and became that much more to the forefront, and just a lot of marches and activism and all that stuff.
You're talking about during the George Floyd lynching?
Yes, yes. Time? That, there and after that whole thing. For a lot of us, those of us who are white, we got criticized and castigated because we didn't do enough. What we did wasn't right. We didn't say enough. What we said, we should have said something else or said something in addition. But you're hanging out with people who aren't getting their words wrong. You're hanging out with people who are, you know, who are actually doing harm to other people, like physical harm, or at least that's a threat. How are you processing all of the racial spike in conversations, which is still kept up to a degree, but it's not quite as there's not as much animosity as there was, you know, a few years ago. How are you processing?
There's still the animosity, but I'm going to explain why we see an uptick in it.
Yeah, good.
Okay.
That's what I'm asking.
I will say this. Okay? Well, first of all, racism has always been around. And, you know, every now and then a major national media attention incident will happen, like, say, the Rodney King thing or the Trayvon Martin thing or the George Floyd thing, right? These things are not uncommon. They've been going on for a long time. But now we have the advent of technology where people can live stream, you know, Rodney King being beat or George Floyd being lynched, you know, and things like this. And people are doing that. So people who are not accustomed to seeing that, and what I mean by that is non-black people, we see it all the time. All right. So this country has been more reactive than proactive. And I would say that we are living in the best time right now because so many people have been in denial or falsely convince themselves that racism is over. Hell, we don't have any more racism. We had a black president. Racism is over. No, it's not. Okay? And, you know, the George Floyd thing, you know, proved that. Let's pinpoint the beginning of the civil rights movement. Let's just say 1955 with Dr. King and Rosa Parks and the bus boycott as the beginning of the civil rights movement. So from 55 to 68, when King was assassinated, we saw a lot of progress, but the pages of progress turned very slowly. All right, and when the powers that be, which is just a polite way of saying the white power structure, when they would look at our protests, our boycotts, our sit-ins, our demonstrations, what did they see? They saw an ocean of black people with a few white people mixed in. There's always been white people who would support, you know, our visions and our equality and things like that. And as I told you before, though, the supremacists, the racists hate those white people more than they hate us. All right. So they just kind of plug their ears and shut us down. You know, those are race traitors that were marching with those black people and all that kind of thing. Right. So we had to fight hard. Now, fast forward to 2020 with George Floyd. And when they saw that live lynching on the internet, on TV, white people were at home, as was everybody, because it was in the height of COVID. What do you do when you're home? You surf the internet. You watch TV. And what do you see? You see a black man being literally lynched on a sidewalk by four police officers. These white people were like, I can't believe this is happening. I have to do something. And so they came out despite the health risk during a pandemic and marched with us against what was going on. All right. As a result, when the powers that be now looked at our protests, our marches, our demonstrations, what did they see? They saw an ocean of black people and an ocean of white people marching together for a common cause. As a result of that collaborative effort, those pages turned a lot faster. Boom. All right. While the protests against the George Floyd thing were directed at police departments all across the country, predominantly the Minneapolis Police Department, which is where Derek Chauvin worked, we saw a larger ripple effect, positive ripple effect that we didn't even expect. Food labels, food brands began changing their labels. Aunt Jemima, Uncle Ben changed their labels. NASCAR, which was ground zero for the Confederate battle flag, banned that Confederate flag from their property. The state of Mississippi removed the Confederate battle flag out of their main flag body. Who would have thought Mississippi would ever have done that? But all of these things happen as a result of that collaborative effort. And so what was the difference between the last big protests and the ones from the civil rights era? The collaborative effort. And that's what we need to seek, to be more collaborative with one another. And that's what will move this country forward.
Yeah, it's a really inspiring thing to see, well, to hear you. When you talk about this stuff, there's not as much of a collective head eye roll. Yeah, because a lot of people, they talk about race, there's just a lot of eye rolls because it's just pandering or just philosophizing or it's just another interesting conversation for someone to have, you know, a debate about or something like that. But, you know, for you and your background and your history and what you've done, the way you've sought people out, gotten to know them, you know, you're one of the few people who, when you talk about race, I'm just going, oh, we need to hear this. It's a person who actually sits with people who could kill them and has actually done and had a lot of uncomfortable experiences and is therefore giving me information that's good to hear. So I really appreciate it, Daryl. That's strong stuff.
Well, you know, there's a benefit to being curious as opposed to being furious.
Oh, now here we go. Here we go. Preach that, as they say. Let's get off race for a moment. Let's just talk about the things that make you tick. This is one of them. Be curious instead of furious. Talk more about that.
Well, you know, what does animosity get you? You know, I mean, the cliche, misery loves company, has been around long before you were born, before I was born. And it's so true. You know, you make somebody, you know, if you're miserable, you want everybody else to be miserable. If you're happy, you want other people to be happy. You want joy around you. You don't want to be brought down.
Right.
And so, you know, what is going through that person's mind that makes them treat you that way? Maybe try to find out. Did they have a bad day? Was it something that their parents told them? Did they read the wrong book? Find out why. You know, they have that mindset. Sit down and talk with them. Let me tell you something. The most effective tool for conflict, whether it's racism, abortion, whatever it is called conversation. It doesn't cost anything to sit down and talk with somebody. When two enemies are talking, they're not fighting. They're talking. They may be arguing. They may even be getting a little loud and disagreeing, but at least they're talking. It's when the conversation ceases, Brian, that the ground becomes fertile for violence. So you want to keep the conversation going.
Yeah. I'm curious about your music background, people you talk with, just some fascinating lists of who's who, Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, B.B. King, not Fats Domino. Did you know Fats Domino?
I knew I knew him very well, yes.
Fascinating. Okay, so one of the things I'm curious about with Jerry Lee Lewis, goodness gracious, great balls of fire.
Which, by the way, was written by a black man, and I was his musical director for 3 years. His name was Otis Blackwell. Ah. Look him up. Otis Blackwell. He wrote Great Balls of Fire. He wrote Breathless for Jerry Lee. He wrote Elvis Presley's biggest song, Don't Be Cruel. He also wrote All Shook Up, Return to Sender. He wrote the song Fever. You give me fever. Boom, boom, boom. Okay.
There you go. Keep great. Singing. Come on now. Come on. Just a line. Come on. Darryl, you said you weren't going to. Come on. You just gave me.
I gave you a little. See, what I did was I give you a little taste. That way you'll bring me back on sometime.
So Jerry Lee Lewis, he was brothers with the famous evangelist Jimmy Swaggart.
He was a cousin.
Oh, cousins.
Yeah. Well, yep, cousin to Jimmy Lee Swaggart and Mickey Gilley, great country singer.
Oh, okay, interesting. So Jerry Lee Lewis, what was his spiritual orientation? Was he a religious man, or was he just in rebellion?
Yes,
he was.
No, he was a very religious guy. He grew up in the church, but he and his cousins, Mickey and Jimmy, Jimmy became the televangelist, Jimmy Lee Swaggart, and Mickey Gilley became a great country singer and piano player as well. They all three of them played piano. What they would do, they're from a town called Faraday, Louisiana, a little town in Louisiana. And, you know, the railroad track goes through, and just like most southern towns, blacks on one side, whites on the other side. And that's where the term comes from. He comes from the wrong side of the tracks.
Oh, right.
It usually means the black side, right? Mm. Okay, so Mickey and Jerry and Jimmy would sneak across the tracks on weekends at nighttime and to this black honky-tonk, this black juke joint. And they'd peep in the windows and watch these black blues and boogie-woogie musicians play the piano.
Yeah.
And that's where they acquired that style.
Fascinating.
Yeah, and yeah, I love Jerry Lee. I know his whole family. I know his daughter, his son. I knew his sister. I knew several of his wives. To me, he was genuine. He was a great person. He was always very kind to me, very nice to me. My band backed him up one time. He has that persona of being some rough and tough, rebellious, hate everybody kind of thing. No, that was not him.
Yeah, that's good. Well, Darryl, is there anything that you want to talk about that we haven't talked about?
Let's talk about the power of music.
Okay.
A lot of people don't realize that music is the great uniter. Hmm. Everybody likes music, whether you're, a white-collar executive or a white-robed Klansman, everybody likes music. And that's how I met the first Klansman, that I sat down and talked to.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
So let's say this Friday night, I don't have a gig and I've been playing all week. So I want to be entertained. I don't want to be the entertainer and I'm off Friday night. So there's a bar, a club down the street. They got a dance floor. They might have a DJ or a band. I want to go hear some music. I want to dance. So I go down to the club. A good song starts being played and I want to dance to it. Dance floor is filling up. I look around to see if I find an unattached woman, and I see some lady sitting at the bar by herself, and she's tapping her hand on the bar in time to the music. So obviously she likes that song. I don't know her, but I'm going to walk over and say, hey, would you care to dance? She goes, yeah, sure. And she pops off the bar stool, and we go out on the dance floor. If it's a slow song, we're like this, turning slowly around on the dance floor. If it's a fact, I don't even know this person. I don't even know her name, right? If it's a fast song, we're apart, we're shaking, whatever. At the end of the dance or the song, I escort her back to the bar. I say, hey, thanks for the dance. My name is Darryl. She says, my name is Susie, whatever. And I say, so what do you do, Susie? And she says, well, I'm, vice president of marketing for Microsoft East Coast. Oh, my. I mean, she's making millions of dollars a year. What do you do, Darryl? I'm a cashier at McDonald's. What am I making a year? Where would two people that far on the financial spectrum come this close without even knowing each other's names? Music did that. We all have that in common. If your computer company that you work for has a party or your bank has a party, The people at the computer party are going to be IT people, computer sales, software, hardware, programmers, those kind of people. That's what you're going to see at that party. If you go, if your bank has a party, it's going to be bank tellers, branch managers, auditors, etc., accountants. But when you go to hear music, everybody is there. You know, the guy who picks up your trash on Saturday mornings, the person who paints the W-O-L line down the highway or street, the banker will be there, the computer programmer. Everybody is there because everybody likes music.
Right.
And so when our economy tanks and the budget, you know, gets crunched, what happens in schools? The first things that get cut are the arts, music, drama, you know, art, things like that. Those are not, I'm not saying this because I'm a musician. I'm saying it because it's true. Those are not luxuries. Music is a necessity, all right? It teaches people how to work, how to play together, ensemble, you know, play in a group, create, you know, be creative. You know, if you're mad, be expressive. Yeah. You know, if you're upset, you can write a sad song. You can play a sad melody. If you're happy, play something joyous. If you're angry, you know, whatever, all right? But it teaches you how to play together. These are things that we need. When you're driving to work and you're stuck in traffic, you got your radio on, listen to music. You're working out at the gym. You got your earbuds in, listening to music. Women doing their aerobics, ironing clothes, whatever they're doing. They got music on. It is a necessity. It's not a luxury.
Well, actually, they weren't the first things to get cut. The first thing that got cut happened a long time ago. It's called shop class. It's called power mechanics. So, you know, hey, you can complain all you want about the choral productions getting cuts. They cut my ilk out decades ago. Like, kids aren't playing power saws or power mechanics, so we're all non-essential, I guess.
Is that what happened to you?
Oh, yes. That's absolutely what happened. My gosh, back in my day, you had table saws and band saws and welders. And, like, it was normal.
But while you were welding and sawing, did you have music on?
Oh, yeah. I love music. I love great. I'm talking about the budget cut. I love music. I'm all about music. But I'm just saying the budget cutting, start with those blue-collar folks. Get those guys. We don't need those guys and those jobs.
Blue-collar folks love music, too. A lot of blue-collar folks play music.
Yeah, and you got enough white-collar people who like the arts to fight for your programs and keep them going, which I'm glad they are going. I'm pro. Indeed. I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I'm just more bitter that there's no shop class anymore. That's the main thing.
I hear you.
Daryl, if anybody wants to get a hold of you or your work, where can they find your stuff and be exposed to all of your great ideas and yourself?
They can go to my website, which is Daryl Davis. That's Daryl, only one R, daryldavis.com. And you're welcome to email me at daryl@daryldavis.com.
Daryl, thank you so much. Thank you for taunting and tantalizing us with that wonderful deep voice. So sorry you put your light under a bushel and you hit it and you didn't sing for us, but maybe again some other time. It was very helpful. You helped us see some real aggressive conversations, aggressive just walking across the room and talking to somebody really, really positive. Hey, folks, let's do something about this. Let's talk to people who are a little different. Let's talk to people who might intimidate us. They're actually just people after all. We'll see you next time on The Aggressive Life. Thanks for joining us on this journey toward aggressive living. Find more resources, articles, past episodes, and live events over at briantome.com. My new books, a repackaged edition of The 5 Marks of a Man, and a brand new 5 Marks of a Man tactical guide are open right now on Amazon. If you haven't yet, leave this podcast a rating and review. It really helps get the show in front of new listeners. And if you want to connect, find me on Instagram @BrianTome. The Aggressive Life is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio.